Hey, Marketplace listeners, you know, around here, we like to think you're never too young to learn about the economy and financial basics. That's why we're bringing the Million Bazillion Live Tour to school to teach important lessons about budgeting, investing, saving, and more. It's all the fun of the podcast, but now live, immersive, and interactive. Special thanks to our tour partner, Greenlight, the debit card and money app for kids and teens. Learn more about Greenlight at greenlight.com/million. That is greenlight.com/million.
Marketplace is produced in association with the University of Southern California.
Energy policy, bank profits, and armpits on the broadcast today, not necessarily in that order. From American Public Media, this is Marketplace. From the Frank Stanton Studios in Los Angeles, I'm Kai Ryssdal. It's Wednesday, the 30th of March today. Good to have you with us, as always. President Obama rolled current events into the coming summer driving season and decided today was a good day to talk energy policy. The fighting in Libya has oil over $104 a barrel. Refiners are going to start changing over to their summertime gasoline formulas soon, so there's a better than even chance that pump prices will rise from where they are today. And that all helps explain why the president found himself at Georgetown University this morning giving a speech, which included, as all presidential energy speeches do, a reference to cutting our dependence on foreign oil. Whether we can finally do it? Here's Sarah Gardner from the Sustainability Desk.
This kind of speech has become a White House tradition. President Nixon called for total energy independence back in 1973. President Obama's goal is less ambitious, although perhaps more realistic.
The United States of America cannot afford to bet our long-term prosperity, our long-term security, on a resource that will eventually run out.
Obama's plan calls for stricter fuel efficiency standards and more electric vehicles, along with a big expansion of energy production here at home. But Obama stressed the limits of America's domestic oil reserves and focused more on boosting production of homemade biofuels and natural gas. But energy expert Amy Myers Jaffe at Rice University says neither will be fueling America's 250 million cars in the next decade.
So there have to be ethanol stations, there have to be CNG natural gas filling terminals, right? And we don't have any of that infrastructure.
Jaffe and others say that's where Obama has to back up his call for more hybrid and electric vehicles with higher fuel efficiency standards overall. Mark Cooper is with the Consumer Federation of America.
This is a moment where they actually have the chance to finally deliver on that promise about changing the trajectory of U.S. gasoline consumption.
Cooper says a new standard of 60 miles per gallon by 2025 would get us there. Obama said today cars getting 50 miles per gallon are already rolling off U.S. production lines. This fall, the White House will announce the next round of fuel standards for cars. We'll see how high they go. I'm Sarah Gardner for Marketplace.
Toyota said today there's no earthquake-induced shortage of car parts just yet, but it does want to make sure its dealers don't create a shortage by hoarding in anticipation of a supply chain slowdown. Rationing replacement parts could be an annoyance for customers and for dealers' bottom lines. Marketplace's Elisa Roth has more now on how the earthquake is affecting the global economy.
Toyota's put more than 230 parts on a special list. Their parts dealers aren't allowed to just order for their inventories anymore.
We can still order the parts, but we have to have a customer who needs the part.
Earl Stewart is a Toyota dealer in North Palm Beach, Florida. He used to place regular orders for extra parts, and some of them he would keep a month's supply in stock. Now Toyota's making it harder to do that.
We're asked to furnish a VIN number, a serial number of the car, name of the customer, and the repair order that the parts being used on.
The parts on the list are mostly for the Prius and the Corolla. Stewart says he can still get whatever parts he needs, but there could be a delay of a day or so. Other Toyota dealers are facing the same issue, but it's still a relatively small problem. A car has tens of thousands of parts, and only about 230 of them are on the list. For now, Toyota does still have them. So what's all this mean for Toyota drivers? Brian Sponheimer is an analyst who follows several big car dealerships at Gabelli. It's an asset management firm.
It will be inconvenient if the parts shortage issue is exacerbated over the course of the next month or so. I think it'll top out at a nuisance, though.
Still, it could end up being more than a nuisance for dealers. a lot of their revenue comes from parts and service, so prolonged delays in parts shipments could end up costing them. I'm Elisa Roth for Marketplace.
Ladies, I don't know how to tell you this, but apparently your underarms aren't all they could be. So says the consumer products company Unilever, which, don't you know it, is launching a new product this week to help you out with that. Marketplace's Nancy Marshall-Genza reports.
Now, I haven't looked closely at my underarms in a while, but I'm pretty sure they're not my best asset. Thankfully, help has arrived for me and millions just like me. Unilever's Dove Ultimate Go Sleeveless Deodorant. It pretties up scaly, discolored underarm skin in just 5 days. The marketing video features a young woman gleefully cutting the sleeves off a pile of shirts, spicy salsa music in the background. But Unilever may be facing a tough sell. It seems we women aren't that worried about our armpits. At least not the women I talked to today. Women like Rosie Wilson. I caught up with her and a friend on their way back from lunch.
Let the armpits take care of itself. Let the hair grow.
30-year-old Asel Esfahani also sees no need for armpit anxiety. She thinks Unilever is trying to sell us a problem.
Marketing's main strategy has been to work off our insecurities and increase them and add even things you never heard about, I guess.
Even marketing experts are skeptical. Larry Weber heads the W2 Group. He says companies like Unilever are getting desperate because the nearly $3 billion deodorant market is saturated.
Big consumer products companies that just are trying to do anything and think of anything for you to buy more.
Come to think about it, the backs of my knees are pretty ugly, too. I can only hope they come up with a solution to that horrible situation soon. In Washington, I'm Nancy Marshall-Genzer for Marketplace.
Wall Street raised its arms to say, sure, today we'll have the details when we do the numbers. Can't say the word oil these days without thinking about Libya and the Middle East. It's not so much that Libya was such a huge producer. It's more the uncertainty over what's going to happen. Commentator David Frum is certain of one thing.
We're never supposed to say this, but look, obviously the conflict in Libya is also about oil. Without oil, Gaddafi could not have become the kind of dictator he is. Without oil, Gaddafi could not afford a mercenary army to suppress his population. Without oil, a Libyan civil war would not look so frightening to the rest of the world. With oil, we have to worry whether the next government of Libya might revert to using its oil wealth to finance terrorism, as Gaddafi did in the 1970s, 1980s, and 1990s. With oil, countries that have contracted to buy Libyan energy have to worry about security of supply and the safety of their investments. Countries do not fight wars for oil. That never makes economic sense. You can buy a lot of oil for the cost of even a small war. But countries do care intensely about security of supply. The possibility that oil-producing Libya might collapse into chaos deeply concerned Britain, France, and Italy. Especially Italy. More than one-fifth of all Italian oil imports come from Libya. History has shown that countries will fight to protect their access to oil. In the mid-1980s, Iran fired missiles at Kuwaiti oil tankers. The United States allowed Kuwaiti ships to fly the American flag and fought a quiet naval war in the Persian Gulf to protect the tankers. The United States fought a full-scale land war to liberate Kuwait and defend Saudi Arabia after Saddam Hussein's 1990 invasion and annexation. If a civil war erupted in Saudi Arabia today, it's hard to imagine how the rest of the world could avoid getting involved. That's good reason to hasten efforts to move off oil. Good reason to welcome the development of oil reserves in stable countries like Canada, now America's top source of oil imports. But it's also an inescapable part of the answer to the question, why some conflicts matter more to us than others. Inevitably, countries care first about their own security, and energy security is crucial to national security.
David Frum was a speechwriter for President George W. Bush. Today, he's the editor of Frum Forum. Next week, Robert Reich, your views anytime. Go to marketplace.org and click on that link that says contact. The Federal Reserve has two main jobs, the dual mandate, it's called. Keep prices stable, that is inflation, and keep employment high. On that first point, they're doing all right. There's not a whole lot of inflation in the American economy right now. Jobs are a different story. In the New York Times today, David Leonhardt writes about the Fed and the hows and the whys of the choices it's making between inflation and jobs. David, good to have you back.
Thank you, Kai.
So with inflation stable and low in this economy, you'd think more people at the Fed would be worried about that employment number. But you point out in the paper this morning, that's not the case.
No, it's not the case. And you would particularly think they would be focused on unemployment because they just made this mistake a year ago. They thought the recovery had taken hold and we were going to have steady declines in unemployment. And so they stopped their efforts to reduce long-term interest rates. And then they were proven wrong, and the recovery basically stalled out last year. And we can't be sure that it's going to stall out now. We certainly are hoping that it's not going to, but there are definitely reasons to worry now. And the Fed still doesn't seem worried about unemployment.
Why? There are a lot of smart people working in that building.
There are a lot of smart people working in that building, and I'm quite confident some of them are worried about unemployment. But I think there are a few things going on. There are some institutional biases at the Fed that cause them to focus on inflation. First, there's the fact that once inflation takes hold, it really is difficult to nip in the bud. I think some of them still remember very much the 1970s. If you think about how old people tend to be when they get in these positions, some of them were growing up then professionally, right?
Yeah.
And so it's their formative experience. There's also this issue that inflation hurts investors much more than unemployment tends to. So the Fed tends to spend more time talking to investors than it does talking to advocates for the unemployed.
And I'm obliged to point out here that as we've seen the past 2 to 3 years, you know, your argument that once inflation takes hold, it sticks around for a while. Once high unemployment takes hold, as we've seen, it's sticking around for a while.
That's a really important point. I mean, even if employment growth picks up rapidly, even if Friday's jobs report is great, we are years away from returning to anything that would be like full employment. And so I think we're going to look back on this period as having high unemployment for easily 5 years, possibly closer to 10. And the lack of alarm about that is worrisome.
Let me play the opposite side of the coin then, David, and point out that households in this country, even when you take out gas and energy prices, they are feeling a little bit of a pinch. Inflation is bubbling up out there and people are rightly feeling squeezed.
That's absolutely right. This is a more complicated call than the Fed's call was, say, last June.
Yeah.
Inflation is increasing a little bit. The reason to be somewhat hopeful that it's not going to keep increasing is that recent history, and now we're talking decades, not months, is that spikes in food and oil prices don't tend to feed into overall price spikes unless you have this wage price spiral in which employees are demanding higher raises. It's really hard to see how workers today have the bargaining power, given the weakness of the economy, to demand higher raises in reaction to the price increases. And so it seems more likely that inflation is going to moderate. And then I would also add that we have to weigh relative risks here. Is there some risk that inflation is going to increase in coming months? Absolutely. But it seems to me really difficult to make the case that the risk is higher than the risk that our recovery is going to stall out, particularly when a lot of the people at the Fed making the prediction that inflation is going to be a big problem have now been making that prediction for a few years and been wrong again and again.
David Leonhardt, he writes the Economic Scene column for The New York Times. David, good to talk to you.
Thank you, Kai.
Coming up, tuition discounts get students in the door.
I don't know anyone here who hasn't gotten financial aid. Most people do.
But how long can that really last? First, let's do the numbers. The Dow Industrials picked up 71 points today. That's a 0.5%. Ended at 12,350. The Nasdaq rose 19 points, almost 0.75%. 2776 at the bell. The S&P 500 tacked on 8 points, 2/3%, finished at 1328. Shares of AT&T rang up more than 2% today. Verizon phoned in an increase of 0.4%. Shares of Quest and Comcast each beamed up about 0.5% today. One big winner was the drug maker Cephalon. Shares soared nearly 30% on news that the company is a takeover target. Shares in Valiant, which made the bid, rose more than 12% today. In other news, Standard & Poor's said it's going to dump biotech giant Genzyme from the S&P 500 stock index. Asset manager BlackRock will take its place. Genzyme, mostly unchanged. BlackRock picked up more than 6% today. Bonds rose. The yield on the 10-year T-note fell to 3.44%. You know what's the name of the show? Oh, yeah. You're listening to Marketplace.
What does Tier 1 Capital have in common with a wedding cake? Visit the Marketplace whiteboard to find out. Our videos demystify finance and economics. Just go to our website, marketplace.org.
From the Marketplace Statebook, here's a look at events coming up Thursday. The Commerce Department reports on factory orders for February. The House Armed Services Committee holds a hearing on U.S. military operations in Libya. And Academy Award-winning actor Christopher Walken turns 68. He's got a long list of credits from The Deer Hunter to Hairspray and a music video to boot. I'm Michelle Filippi.
This is Marketplace from APM American Public Media. I'm Kai Rizdal. Down deep in the economic hubbub in Washington this week, past the debate on whether the government's going to shut down or not, beyond arguments over how to fix the mortgage industry, there's a little meeting the American Chamber of Commerce is holding about banking and about how regulation is going to cut into their profits. J.P. Morgan Chase CEO Jamie Dimon complained today that American banks are going to start losing out to foreigners. But when you consider that the financial industry's profits last year were about 30% of all U.S. corporate profits, it doesn't really sound too much like they're suffering. Marketplace's Heidi Moore reports.
It's good to be a big American bank now. There are fewer competitors. Profits are high enough that they have some left over to give back to shareholders as dividends. Yet whenever bankers go to Washington, they complain that their profits will be devastated by regulation, while foreign banks thrive. Douglas Elliott isn't buying it. He's a former J.P. Morgan executive who's now a senior fellow at the Brookings Institution. When it comes to regulation, he says, banks will get over it.
There's a lot of exaggeration. There isn't any big problem here. Many of the parts of our industry just aren't going to move to Asia anytime soon.
U.S. banks are actually doing better now than their foreign rivals, says Lawrence Franco. He's a senior analyst with Delaware Investments, which owns shares of Goldman Sachs and J.P. Morgan.
Our folks in the banking world complain a lot about our more intrusive regulatory environment. U.S. financial services companies, especially the banks and the investment banks, have really come out of this quite well compared to international competitors.
In fact, Barclays, the British bank, may even be looking to move to New York. Elliott says more regulation comes with costs, but it will make the banking system safer.
Banks need to earn a reasonable profit. But what we don't want is for the sector to earn huge profits, because excess profits always come off the backs of the customers.
Regulation may shave profits, but under the new law, the biggest U.S. banks are still too big to fail. That alone gives them a competitive advantage. In New York, I'm Heidi Moore for Marketplace.
It's Wednesday, long about mid-show. Here comes the music.
I'm going to sit right down and write myself a letter.
We did a couple of stories this past week that really piqued your collective interest. The first one was about Dutch farmers who were invited to Iowa to start dairy farms. About a quarter of them went broke, so then they went home. Eric Reuter farms vegetables on 2 acres near Columbia, Missouri. And he says what happened in Iowa is a good example of what's wrong with agriculture policy today.
The best way to benefit family farms and independent American agriculture is to get out of the way. Reform destructive or counterproductive subsidy programs. Reform overreaching regulation. Stop trying to force the price of food to unsustainable lows. And make choices that allow more of food's retail price to reach the actual farmer.
The other story that got a lot of comments was my interview with author Seth Godin about his new book and his publishing venture. Seth said at one point in our conversation about the way the economy is changing that the industrial age is dying. Linda Lewis wrote from Salem, New York, to say that actually it's still very much alive, just not here.
The industrial age and all its worst features has been outsourced to other places, to poor countries all over the world. Most Americans are almost perfectly unconscious of the conditions in the factories that now manufacture most of the products bought by the American consumer.
And, said Steve Bailey of Albany, California, that benefits those at the top of the wealth structure, not the rest of us.
I think that we will eventually regret the decision to allow our manufacturing capabilities to slip away to other countries. Bravo to entrepreneurs. But entrepreneurs without workers only have an idea.
If you have an idea about the broadcast, send it along. Our website is marketplace.org. All you have to do is click on that link that says contact. High school seniors are starting to hear from colleges this week, and if I remember right, if the envelope is fat, that's a good sign. There's admissions paperwork to fill out inside, and often a financial aid offer. What's listed as tuition is actually more like the sticker price, and that financial aid offer is kind of like a car salesman telling you what the price will be for you. Colleges are discounting tuition for so many students that the average amount families pay has actually fallen the past 10 years. That's according to the College Board. And while those discounts sound like a good deal for students, and they are, they're a big headache for schools. From the Marketplace Education Desk at WYPR in Baltimore, Amy Scott reports.
McDaniel College is the picture of a small private liberal arts school. It sits on a hill in Westminster, Maryland, its brick buildings overlooking the distant Catoctin Mountains. And as at most colleges, its tuition has climbed steadily. This year, the sticker price reached $33,000, up 29% from 5 years ago.
That's how much it is, but that's not how much we pay.
Lindsay Wilson is a senior at McDaniel.
I don't know anyone here who hasn't gotten financial aid. Most people do.
In fact, the average student at McDaniel pays just about half price. Most of its 1,700 undergraduates get some kind of grant or scholarship from the school. It's called tuition discounting, and the National Association of College and University Business Officers says colleges are doing more of it. The group's president, John Walda, says in the 2008 school year, colleges gave their students an average 42% break on tuition. Sounds great for students, but Walda says for the schools, there's a downside.
The net tuition collected by these universities actually fell by 2.5%. This is the first time in our study that we have seen a decline in the net tuition collected, and as you might predict, this isn't a sustainable situation.
Especially for small liberal arts schools, not the wealthy ones you've heard of, like Williams or Amherst, but colleges like McDaniel that draw mostly regional students. Jane Wellman directs the nonprofit Delta Cost Project. She says these schools virtually live on tuition, now more than ever, with declines in government support as well as endowments and donations. At the same time, Wellman says the colleges have to compete for students.
So you've seen tuition discounting go up most sharply in those kinds of institutions because that's the way they're getting the students.
The liberal arts business model, small classes, mostly full-time faculty, leafy campuses, is also expensive. Colleges have to charge enough to cover those costs, but not so much that they drive students away. Ethan Seidel is vice president for administration and finance at McDaniel. He's also an economist.
The challenge for higher education, and has been for a long time and will continue to be, is how do we maintain access at reasonable prices and still generate enough revenue to provide a quality product.
McDaniel is developing other sources of revenue, like a commercial real estate arm that leases property in town. Seidel says the college has also started offering lower-cost online classes and expanded its graduate programs.
Graduate school classes occur in the evenings, weekends, and over the summer. So all of these are times that it gives us the opportunity to take advantage of facilities we already have to recruit more students, generate more income, and actually help meet the bills.
To keep enrollment up, McDaniel has stepped up its marketing. Earlier this decade, the school changed its name from Western Maryland College, partly to seem less local. Recruiters start courting students in 10th grade, and the college is constantly updating its buildings. At McDaniel's sparkling new fitness center, students let off steam.
My name is Jake Nichols. I'm a junior here at McDaniel College. I'm a double major in business economics.
Nichols is from nearby Frederick, Maryland. He says he had a choice of schools.
Based on the financial aid that was given to me here, I came here because it was a lot less than all the other schools.
Nichols says he's paying about half price. McDaniel gave him a mix of need-based grants and merit scholarships. With a 4.4 grade point average in high school, he's the kind of student colleges fight for with aid. But how long can they afford to keep it up? John Walda, who represents college business officers, says the money has to come from somewhere.
And we pretty well know where it comes from. It comes from cost savings in other parts of the institution.
In McDaniel's case, that's meant frozen salaries the past few years and positions unfilled. Walda says the risk is that the more colleges spend on aid to attract students, the less they'll have to offer the students who come. In Westminster, Maryland, I'm Amy Scott for Marketplace.
Marketplace is produced in association with the University of Southern California's Annenberg School for Communication and Journalism.
This final note today, a look ahead, if you will, to the jobs report coming out Friday morning. The Business Roundtable issued its quarterly CEO confidence report today, and they're feeling pretty good about things, the people in the corner offices are. Nice for them, but also potentially good for the economy, because happy CEOs are hiring CEOs. More than half said they had expected to add jobs and spending in the next 6 months. We'll see what Friday morning brings. 8:30 Friday morning Washington time for that jobs report. But for now, that's Marketplace from APM, American Public Media. Vahan Baladuni, Ravi Karman, Stephen Colon, Bradford Craig, Eric Johnson, Jeff Peters, and Charlton Thorpe engineer the program for us. I'm Kai Rizdahl. We'll see you back here tomorrow. This is APM, American Public Media. With access to so much information, it's hard to feel like an informed, discerning citizen. That's why on Make Me Smart, which is a podcast from Marketplace, we make it easy for you to stay in the know. Hi, I'm Kai Rizdahl. Every weekday, Kimberly Adams and I unpack the latest from Washington, D.C.
The Senate Minority Leader has announced that he will step down as the Republican leader.
What's happening in AI? I mean, don't buy at the top, but holy cow, artificial intelligence and all the companies related to it are the hot new thing. And we do the numbers.
So as a refresher, inflation is the rate of increase in the prices of things. It's not just sort of things getting more expensive. It's the speed at which things get more expensive.
Because in a world that's constantly changing, we all need to stay smart. Listen to Make Me Smart wherever you get your podcasts.